Hey, welcome to the Toronto Today podcast. My name's Greg Brady. Hope everybody's doing okay. I'm the host of Toronto Today, which you can hear on the radio weekday mornings, 5:30 a.m. to 9 a.m. on 640 Toronto. We put together the best highlights of the day's show, and today is Friday, April 26th. Let's start it off with Think Tank. We dive into some of the day's top stories with three panelists. Roy Green is the award-winning host of The Roy Green Show on the Chorus Radio Network. You hear that Saturday and Sunday, 2 to 5 o'clock, right here on 640 Toronto in the PM. Lindsay Maskell, strategist and former advisor to Premier Dalton McGuinty. And Ben Mulrooney, who you often hear on Toronto This Weekend, 7 a.m. to 10 a.m. Saturdays and Sundays. Let's get it going with the Friday Think Tank. Let's start with this. I think it's news. I know it is when someone is asked to remove themselves from a house of politics and they choose not to, and everybody has an opinion on it. We'll see if this was a one-day incident. But yesterday, independent Ontario MPP Sarah Jama from Hamilton Centre wouldn't budge, and she wasn't going to budge on removing the keffiyeh that she was wearing. She wasn't going to budge when she was, in essence, kicked out of Queen's Park. Here's her reaction after the incident.
Another member was able to wear today a political piece of clothing that he named as such as being political and was not asked to be removed. We've had members across this chamber wear clothing in support of Ukraine and other international issues. And this is an issue that's affecting people here as well. There are Palestinians that actually work in this building. There are Palestinians who are affected by decisions by this government. And if Doug Ford, our own premier, has even said that the ban shouldn't exist, they should move a motion in line with that.
Okay, there's a lot there. Let me start with you, Roy. Again, we've seen people kicked out of the House of Commons. You're not allowed to call anybody a liar. You're using a prop. There's this, there's that. But this was, in essence, and I'll use the phrase, a Rosa Parks moment for Sarah Jama. Circumstances very different, but she wasn't moving, and the speaker said, I was not going to find a way to have security physically remove her. It should be noted for people that don't know, she has a disability and uses a wheelchair. So, Roy, there's the practicality of this, and there's the optics of it as well.
Greg, the Speaker of the Legislature has responsibilities established and supported by the Legislature. Speaker Ted Arnott reached the conclusion that the wearing of a keffiyeh contravenes the rule that items of clothing or other symbols displayed to make a political statement is out of bounds in the seat of the provincial government. The rule is not specific to the keffiyeh, and it does not single out any identifiable group, even though MPP Jama accuses the anti-Palestinian racism exists in the legislature. Look, the political parties representing Ontario have lined up against the speaker's decision, making, I think, his job untenable. If MPP Jama will not abide by the speaker's decision and the parties do not support Mr. Arnott, I would say options are really reduced to the MPP being ordered out of the legislature until she abides by the rules order, or if he doesn't have the support of the political parties on this issue, Mr. Arnott's only position and option is to resign the position as speaker. The noisy public exchanges is another case of politics trumps rules as politicians and their parties scramble for the high ground of public support.
I think people are walking and chewing gum at the same time on this one, Lindsay, because I even talked to a couple MPPs not from the Conservative Party yesterday, and they say, hey, it's a distraction. We got business to do. We've got practical things we need to do for the people of Ontario. But then I see their bubbles on the text moving, and then they're giving me five paragraphs of opinion on it. So they've got an opinion on it. This is theatrical in a way, but it is, to Roy's point, it's created a divide between Doug Ford and the Speaker. It's created a little bit of a fissure in the Conservative Party, and it's seen as a way to gain political capital right now for the NDP. It's all of those things.
Yes. I mean, a lot of it's unfortunate because now what's happened is this has become performative, really, and MPP Jama is getting what she wants of the attention and focus on this. Look, this is a rare thing that all of the parties agree that the speaker's ruling happened. The thing that is unfortunate is I actually think there's another way to fix this. Having worked at Queen's Park, when you know the rules, there are other ways, and especially when you have a majority Conservative government, you have one member who keeps voting against that. At some point, that woman is not going to be in the House. They can fix this. There are other mechanisms to fix this. But all the parties agree that the motion shouldn't have happened. And we actually should allow religious dress and freedom in the legislature. And this is unfortunately turned into a way to cause a big destruction.
Ben, beyond the obvious in that it's created a wonderfully catchy phrase, JAMA drama. beyond that, how do you view it?
Look, you know, I may be an outlier on this because you said everybody has an opinion. I'm all over the place because I just don't care. I just don't care. I think we have bigger issues in the province of Ontario. I think Ontarians are not concerned with this. It is theater. I would have let this go. Like, if she wants to wear it, if anybody wants to wear it, let them face the voters. I believe it's not an inclusive message. And if you need props to sell your story, to sell your message, but then you're the carrot top of the legislature. And so to me, I would have just let it go because there are far bigger issues in the world and in Ontario. Now, that being said, look, John Fraser, the Liberal MPP, took issue and I believe he was trying to capitalize by saying that the premier is the premier of the entire province and not just the leader of his party. Mm-hmm. And I agree. I 100% agree. And he represents everyone, including the Jewish community, for whom this is an inflammatory thing. And so, I don't care. I don't care.
But why did Ted Arnott care? And that's to your point. Does he not know how? Yeah. There's a real breakdown in communication to point out, because if Doug Ford does not know Ted Arnott's doing this, and if Ted Arnott doesn't know that Ford's going to go, just leave her alone and let her wear the keffiyeh, then they got to have better lines of communication. There's a breakdown somewhere. And it's been rare, Ben. You and I have talked about this with this party. Almost 6 years in, they've generally all walked together. Outside of vaccine mandates for some members, they've walked together and there has not been division. They got a bit of an issue on that front right now.
Yeah, listen, I think Doug Ford's doing the right thing. He's not whipping his vote. He's letting he's going to let his party vote the way they want. And that includes Jewish members of his caucus or people who represent Jewish constituents. So, look, I don't see this as an issue that's going to stick to Doug Ford. I think he's doing what he should do, which is staying out of it.
But Roy, you're
not his position clear. There you go.
Roy, you're not sure Ford is doing the right thing here. You feel I don't want to put words in your mouth. Should he have backed the speaker on this?
Well, I'm saying it's as much an issue surrounding the speaker as it is the MPP. That's what it's become. And the question is, do we have a speaker who is empowered to make rules for the legislature? That's the job. And if it's now regressed to the position, the place that it's in, the speaker has two choices, walk or enforce the rule. That's the only position, one of those positions he has to take if the political parties are aligned against him. The question again is, and I said this before, we now have noisy public exchanges on this. And I think, again, it's a case of politics trumping rules as the politicians and their parties are scrambling for the high ground of public support. It happens over and over and over. Remember, I told you last Friday, that the EU's top court ruled an employer may ban the wearing and display of religious and cultural items if the employee engages with the public in his or her work environment, as long as the prohibition is applied evenly. This isn't just an Ontario issue. It's a growing national issue, and it is already an international matter.
Yeah, it is. And I you know, if social media didn't exist, if we were sitting here in 1986, I think the world would be a lot different and a lot more. There'd still be theater, but a lot of the practical work would happen.
Social media opinion, very strong. If you have a look at X/Twitter, I know that don't necessarily represent a cross-section of the public, but it's there. And and I take Ben's point, but this has now moved to a point where it is a discussion issue. It is a matter that people want to become involved in because you can identify with the issue.
Let me move to this Honda plant announcement yesterday. I'll start with Lindsay here. $15 billion Ontario. Alliston gets an electric vehicle plant. $2.5 billion invested from the federal government in terms of tax credits. But basically, $2.5 million of taxpayer money goes right to Honda to get this going. I want to play you a clip from Justin Trudeau, and then we'll ask you what your thoughts are on a big company like this getting such a massive subsidy. Here's the Prime Minister.
A whole ecosystem will be built with 4 new manufacturing plants in Ontario, including an EV assembly plant, a standalone battery manufacturing plant, and two plants for battery components. These investments will create well over 1,000 well-paying manufacturing jobs, as well as many, many construction jobs, and of course, jobs all across Ontario and the country for auto parts suppliers.
Okay. It's a bit of a wager, Lindsay, and people kind of hesitate and they tense up when a lot of public money is given to a very rich corporation. And I'll bring up the amount, $5 billion from both levels of government to add 1,000 jobs. Sounds to many like it's $5 million a job. Like, that's the math. So these jobs have to become careers and there has to be a lot of spinoff. What would you say about it?
Yeah, this is a real moment of deciding if Canada is going to be a place where we're going to be the, you know, EV center of the world, have the new future of automotive design, or are we going to let it go to China? Because they are moving faster and making a cheaper EV right now. So are we going to let it go there, or are we going to make it Canadian? Now, we also do have to compete with the U.S., obviously, on the Inflation Reduction Act. And so that means big investments from our government. My main concern is making sure that they get it better than they did with Nexstar.
Yep.
Nexstar just kept coming back for more money. And when we have a real immigration issue right now, the fact that we're not fighting for every single Canadian construction job on the install, we need to not be spun by companies and fight for, you know, that basically we need to have labor conditionality on these kind of investments. But I think it's a great investment. It's definitely where we need to be going. Change is hard for some people, but this investment will pay off.
Ben, it's a great point Lindsay makes. There's got to be a commitment to Canadian workers, and that will come in time. But not doing anything may not be a better option. We all know when automotive factories close in the United States, somebody looks at a governor or a president or a senator and says, how could you let this happen? We're facing that in Oshawa just 5 years ago here in our province, and it looked like it was going to go very, very badly. What do you think about yesterday?
I think it was a great day. I think it was a fantastic day. Ontario reasserted itself as the center of the automotive universe in Canada. I think the fact that two levels of government of representing different parties coming together and finding common cause was fantastic. In the back of my head, I'm always reminded about the giant bank bailout in the United States about 20 years ago. Or 15 years ago, when massive amounts of public money went to these banks and immediately bonuses were paid to executives with that money. It was disgusting because they didn't pay attention to the details. And so I completely take the point, protecting Canadian workers, ensuring that these jobs go to Canadian workers at every single step is paramount. Otherwise, it will be viewed as a waste of money, as opposed to what it really is, an investment in the future of transportation, which could bolster this province for generations.
Roy, is it a bet worth making? And I bring this up because in Mexico, I'll give you the list: Tesla, Volkswagen, Mercedes, BMW, Ford, and GM. They build most of their electric vehicles in Mexico. And the only lesson to learn is, obviously, we don't want labor as cheap or working conditions like they have in Mexico. Ours are better, and we pay our workers more. But there's always that risk that if it doesn't stay here, it goes somewhere else, and there's no jobs at all.
Yeah, Greg, the question is, and I agree with Lindsay and Ben, it can be a tremendous boon to this province and the country. But the question is whether Honda can be more successful in production and sales of EVs than Ford and Tesla and other manufacturers who've scaled back their investment and engagement in electric vehicle production and sales, at least for the time being. And what are the safeguards protecting the $5 billion in public monies, $2.5 billion from Ontario, $2.5 billion from the federal government? Honda says all its vehicles globally will be electric by 2040. Okay, let's see. But let's make sure that whatever public monies are directed toward underwriting private automaker costs in Ontario are not just pulling the lid off an eventual bottomless pit of financial support demands, as in, either you give us more money or we'll relocate. It's an important issue to make sure that we've got it covered.
Roy, a lot of great NFL stadiums and NHL arenas have been built that way. Blackmail, that's called.
Yeah, but you show me an NFL franchise that is failing.
No, I know. They just say, hey, we can make even more money if we go from St. Louis to L.A. or we go from Houston to Nashville.
Yeah.
It happens on every. I mean, let's face it. Toronto was trying to grab their own franchise way back when. Let me move to this. And it comes to family medicine. And I guess hope on the horizon. The headline in the Globe and Mail: more graduates will pursue family medicine in Canada, up from 2023. But let me go to Ben on this, and I'll lay this stat on the audience, Ben. This is from theglobaleconomy.com. Canada has 2.73 doctors per 1,000 people. And this is in 2021, so this is kind of squeezing out of the pandemic. Austria has 5.35. Norway has tons more. Spain, Germany. You name your European country, they've got more doctors per 1,000 people. And I don't know how we change that. What are your thoughts on where we're going?
We've got a lot more doctors than we think. They're just driving. They're working for Uber. There's a bunch of doctors in this country that could be working if we were able to fast track some sort of harmonization between the skills that they got in another country and the need that we have in this province and in this country. I had a realization a couple of days ago that my dog has better access to medicine than I do. When I took her down to the vet, for pink eye that she had. We have to stop putting our heads in the sand and thinking that our system is the end all be all. And you're not going to find a lot of people in this country disagreeing with the dream and the goal of universal healthcare. Across the political divide, you're going to find support for that. But the end all be all is not the single payer system that it clearly has been stretched beyond its limits. The goal is healthcare for all. And I think we have to shift the paradigm in our thinking to how we can fix this, because throwing more money at this problem is not the solution. Well, I think we really have to expand and be innovative and bold and take risks, because the alternative is the crisis that we find ourselves in.
Lindsay, I think Ben has it. And even more family doctors will not do much to reduce wait times in emergency rooms. It won't do much for people waiting for a scan or a diagnostic. And it won't do much for people who want a surgery sooner than later and they fly somewhere else or they drive to the States. A family doctor won't change that.
Well, it will certainly help with reducing the flow in and out of emergency rooms and better scheduling and adding competition into the system. Just more doctors is going to be better for our system. So not only do we have doctors that aren't working full time here, we have many, many Canadian doctors that aren't doing full hours, full shifts is what we would expect. We also, as Ben mentioned, foreign trained physicians that are here in the country. But the craziest thing to me is the number of Canadian nationals that go to medical school outside of Canada and fight hard as hell to get a job to come back to Canada. And we make it very difficult for somebody who is born in Canada. A friend of mine that went to medical school in St. Vincent and the Grenadines. And why wouldn't you want to go to school there?
No snow. You don't need to shovel snow there on your way to class that day. Yeah.
Impossible. It is easier for somebody to come as a temporary foreign worker than a medically trained professional to come work in Canada when they are a Canadian, which is sad. But more doctors, more competition in the system is going to be better for our system.
Roy, the amount of times I'm listening to your show. Go ahead, Ben, quick. Yeah.
So one last thing about it. Having these doctors want to become family doctors is great, but the burnout rate of family doctors in this province and in this country is astounding. The amount of paperwork per patient, I think it's like 3 hours of paperwork per 1 hour of working with a patient, is driving these people to early retirement. It's a top heavy system with outlandish bureaucratic responsibilities that is foisted upon these people that makes it so, yeah, sure, you want to be a family doctor, but you're not going to be one for long.
Roy, I got a couple minutes here for you to stretch it out. And Ben brings up the paperwork. I could be driving around listening to your show, and I think within a 10-minute span, I'll hear the phrase from you or one of your guests, red tape. Red tape, red tape, government red tape, regulations. It constantly gets in the way of things we want to accomplish in Canada.
Well, it does. And the bureaucracy confronting family physicians, particularly, as Ben just pointed out, is massive. But let's go back to the beginning here. Family medicine is under huge stress. 6.5 million Canadians have no primary care physician. That's the first link, as I keep saying on the air, and the healthcare chain massively compromised across the country. Now look, just a few months ago, the news was that new medical grads were not interested in family medicine as a career. Now the tune is changing, at least somewhat. But what does a few hundred or a few thousand new family doctors really mean as far as addressing that huge 6.5 million Canadians without a family doctor crisis is concerned? Look, older doctors, besieged by bureaucracy, Ben's right, and limited pay, are retiring faster than the general population. One option, of course, it's constantly talked about, is the licensing of international medical school graduates. And I agree with that as long as they're able to pass the examinations placed in front of Canadian medical school grads. And remember, Canada is in last place as far as access to primary care is concerned of the 10 countries surveyed on this issue, according to a release of the survey just last month. I think with the current story, we have a headline, not a solution.
Yeah, that uptick might not even cover this wave of family doctor retirements that we know is happening right now and we know is only going to grow. I got to leave it there. Thanks so much, Lindsay, Ben, Roy. All of you have a great weekend. Ben, Roy, I'll be listening tomorrow.
Thank you, guys.
That was Think Tank. We hear that every weekday at 7:35. We run it right through to Dave Bradley's 8 o'clock news. Our next guest, Vic Fedeli, is the Ontario Minister of Economic Development. And the big Honda electric vehicle announcement took a lot of attention. But what about the money that's being spent by the province, $2.5 billion, and that not only has to create jobs, it has to spin off into a lot of other aspects of the economy. How did yesterday land for you in terms of getting this done? And what is sort of the genesis of working with the federal government in deciding how this is going to go, who steps up to the table with what? How do those deals manifest themselves?
Yeah, thank you. This is a incredibly meaningful deal for the people of Ontario because, you know, it basically defines the kinds of communities we want to live in. We want communities that have big manufacturing plants because they're the linchpins of the community. That's how we get schools and hospitals locating and new police and fire and roads and bridges. So, you know, it really is critical because of the jobs that it's created. But it did take a long time. It was about 2 years ago, almost 2 years ago, that we first sat down in Tokyo with Honda to talk about what are we going to do in Alliston about electric, you know, about making electric vehicles in your plant. And so, you know, Premier Ford was extremely instrumental. He met with Honda and their joint venture partners at his home on two separate occasions. And, you know, Greg, there's just no better deal closer than Premier Doug Ford. When that big mitt comes across the table and shakes the hand, they know they got a deal.
Is there a back and forth that happens with the federal government? Is it a little bit like a contract negotiation? And then at the end of the day, you shake hands and you both land on in essence, $2.5 billion to push in?
Well, Ontario has the people on the ground here. We have a Ministry of Economic Development that does the due diligence, that does the site selection, the tour, you know, whether it's the soil that needs to be analyzed, all of the different things, the return on investment. That's our ministry that does a lot of that, real solid legwork. Now, the federal government has a program of tax credits. So any company that's producing products here under the new budget can get a tax credit of up to 30%. But they put a special piece in the budget that says if you build an electric vehicle and two other components, well, you get this add-on tax credit. So that's where the federal government came in with a $2.5 billion tax credit for Honda over the life of so many years.
Vic Fedeli is our guest on Toronto Today. Now, I mentioned this as a bet. This could go very well based on the EV market and based on how efficient this production is. But you know, and I know, you know your business history. At times, there have been subsidies. Bombardier is a great example where there's a lot of taxpayer money and it doesn't end up paying off. What needs to happen, Vic, for this deal to go right and for the money to be a great investment?
Yeah, that's a great question, Greg, because we've made a business. You're right. You're the first person that talks about that. We've made a business decision. We want to be in this business. We have 100. When we took office, we had 100,000 auto workers who really had no future because none of the companies were going to be making EVs. They were all going to have the gas-powered replacement of the horse and buggy. And for 125 years, we've been making combustion engine vehicles, and there were no new products announced. In fact, Reuters announced in 2019 there'll be $300 billion spent worldwide on EV and zero was coming to Canada. Well, that's ostensibly zero for Ontario, where all the autos are made. And Premier Ford said, we're going to turn this around. We visited each auto plant. We understood what they needed. We lowered taxes by $8 billion a year to help all of the companies across Ontario, not just the auto sector, and said, we want to be in the EV sector. And we went from zero in 3 years to $28 billion of EV. And now, after 4 years, $43 billion and tens of thousands of new jobs. So you save 100,000 auto workers by having a new product for them to make, and you get into all the ancillary businesses like batteries. And now we're adding tens of thousands of new jobs.
The market needs to move too, doesn't it? We're at 10% right now among new auto sales. I would tell you, and I think you and the Premier have made the case, federal interest rates where the Bank of Canada is sitting at 5%, it doesn't help new car sales. The economy doesn't help new car sales. But, Vic, as a percentage of the marketplace, EVs need to grow a lot more than 10%. Where do you see them going in the next 4 or 5 years in terms of that percentage?
Well, throughout the year, there's ups and downs, but the trend is solidly upward. Look, last year alone, global spending in EVs was up 31%. So that's significant. We think that in 6 years, if you look at 3 years ago, it was $2.5 billion. In 6 years, it'll be $50 million. EVs that are sold. We think about 60% of all cars will be EVs by 2030. That will be necessary to meet those mandates that the governments around Canada, the U.S., and around the world put in. So we're lining our workers. We're investing in the workers. That was our real priority, Greg.
The one answer I didn't hear yesterday, and I've got you here, so I'm going to ask, the absolute commitment from Honda that these jobs at this particular plant are Canadian jobs. Is that there? Is there paperwork involved from the brass at Honda getting these government subsidies, putting in a ton of their own money as well, to make that commitment to Canadian workers? I know there's some controversy, and you know as well, in Windsor, just getting things up and running in the training departments, and there's a couple different stories happening there. What's been guaranteed for Canadian jobs for Alliston?
Yeah, first of all, we insist on it. We insist on Ontario workers. Look, we don't discuss our business contracts, but I will say we insist on Ontario workers. But of course, like, we've never built a battery before in Canada. So there are going to be short-term technical experts that come over, uncrate these newfangled pieces of equipment. But they're here to do setup and training. And that's the real emphasis on training. They're going to be training our people on how to use this first ever equipment. Look, I live in North Bay in a mining community where we make mining equipment. And we ship mining equipment all over the world. I have friends who go to Mongolia to install equipment that was made in North Bay. They'll be gone months at a time to install that. They come back, and the companies in Mongolia, they're running the equipment now. That's how equipment is shipped around the world. So I think those short-term technical experts are important, that we get it right and we be trained here, but we insist on Ontario workers.
And like short-term, what are we talking about? 6 months, 8 months? I know the Honda CEO, Toshihiro Miebe, told an organization yesterday they'd have to boost the number of foreign workers as they expand. And that's understandable. But is short-term 6 months? Is it a year after it opens? What are we looking at?
Yeah, again, we just can't get into the business contract, but we insist on Ontario workers be the workers that build these batteries.
On the other front, you mentioned the infrastructure that a plant like this helps in terms of communities, and there's been so much. Your government has pledged housing, and as you're well aware, housing needs infrastructure, roads, schools, community centers, even business to come for grocery stores and whatnot. Where would you say the lay of the land on that is? It's been hard. We've heard from so many people call our show and say, right now, the work stalled a little bit. It's expensive to build. Interest rates haven't gone down. Again, with that, where's the lay of the land right now in terms of getting the homes built that this government has pledged to build?
Well, we're incentivizing communities. I know the Premier and Minister of Municipal Affairs and Housing and others have been out throughout the province presenting the checks to those communities from the Building Faster Fund. Even in my own hometown, again, in North Bay, we got our check because our community built, I think it's like 207% of what our quota to build was in order to meet this demand of 1.5 million homes in 10 years. So, that cash incentive, it's more than $1 billion, is out there to tell these communities, get going. You can't just approve building permits. You've got to get the shovels in the ground in these communities. Plus, we have additional monies to help with sewer and water and other infrastructure. So we're putting every resource, we're pouring resources, because we know we can't attract, we're wildly successful attracting $43 billion worth of business. Got to have people in a home to be able to do that.
Some mayors are being more helpful than others. Is there pressure? Is there a little tightening of the screws to put on, I guess, more of the NIMBY mayors than the YIMBY mayors, Vic?
Well, I would say, I'll compare it to doing this deal. There's no better closer than Premier Doug Ford. I've said this many times, when his mitt comes across the table and shakes your hand at the table of Honda, you got a deal. I would say it's the same thing with the mayors. When that mitt comes out to shake your hand, you better be ready to deliver.
Vic Fedeli, Ontario Minister of Economic Development, Job Creation and Trade. Thanks for the time this morning and have a great weekend.
Thanks, Greg.
Thanks to Vic Fedeli for joining us. Now, Mike Van Solen, a crisis communications specialist. We will talk specifically out of the gate about TikTok. A lot of legislation and maybe an outright ban on it in the United States, and we've done very little of it here. What about that particular brand? But before that, universities. We're seeing graduations, ceremonies, riots, and violence at campuses all across the United States. It's a troubling time, and especially for Jewish students. So we weigh in on that. Universities. I want to play you a video I was meaning to get to earlier, and you jam up a bunch of stuff. This is a graduate student, or a senior rather, an undergrad at the University of Southern California, known for their football. I think you and I would agree, Mike.
For sure.
But they've canceled grad because they're worried about disturbances, and we've seen all the video about disturbances on campus. And I want to talk about sort of that brand that a university is when things like this happen. This video grabbed me. I sent it around to a few friends. They said it grabbed them exactly the same way. Here's her making a video documenting how there's no graduation ceremony for her after 4 years of hard work.
The seniors that are graduating college right now are the seniors that graduated in 2020, where we didn't have a high school graduation. And a lot of us had like drive-through fake graduations or no graduation at all. And now we are seniors about to graduate, getting ready for our first real graduation, and it just got canceled. I'm in shock right now. We, as a whole senior class, have never had a real graduation because of COVID first, which we thought was like a one-time thing, like we're the class that got screwed over. It is what it is, unlucky. Now, USC just canceled it. We've all worked so hard to get here. USC, I'm sure you know, is not an easy school to get into. And so everyone that goes here is very accomplished, like had worked really hard to get in, and now they just canceled our freaking graduation. Like, what now? What now? They sent out an email 10 minutes ago about how they know it's disappointing, but they're canceling it, and they're going to have other fun events, which I don't even know what that means. Like,
really hits a lot of people. It's a once, like you think 2020, once in a lifetime, what can we do? You can't get those years back. We'll try and make it up to you. And then 4 years later, you're like, okay, smooth sailing, and I can live my life, and I'm at college now, and bang, this.
Yeah, no, it's you feel for them. Look, I have a daughter who lost her grade 8 graduation, and if, she's going to graduate from grade 12 this year. So
imagine that prom getting scrubbed, right, or the commencement.
Exactly. Yeah. It's a challenging time for universities dealing with these protests, and these are places academic freedom's important. They believe in the value of free speech. But there's also an implicit contract they have with every one of those students that they'll get an experience, not just in the classroom, but it's the whole experience, which includes living in dorms, growing up, really becoming an adult, and graduating, and, having your parents there to celebrate it. And it breaks my heart a little bit. And I think of all the kids in my life too, who were robbed by COVID and then to have this happen. So I understand the anguish she's feeling.
Do you think there's any brand damage being done to the idea of universities or colleges as a whole? I'd like to think not. I'm a huge believer in them. I wouldn't trade the 4 years I was at Western for anything. I loved every, I'm sure there were hard times. I'm sure I punched a pillow a couple of times, but I look back and it's amazing how you can only remember the good things. You don't remember the stress and being broke and breakups and being angry at your roommates and all that stuff. You only remember good things. Is there any bit of damage that you see kind of cracking the foundation of why they matter to us?
Well, I think there is. I think this is a really challenging time. You know, what I would offer is we need time. We are in the middle of it now. This is the fog of, you know, call it the fog of war. So universities are dealing with this really challenging times as a result of the war in Israel. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of people very passionate on both sides of this issue, and they are impacting the ability of other students and people just to go about their school life. So is it impacting? Absolutely. Look at Harvard. We've seen the president of Harvard got fired. We've seen alumnus who are critical, particularly in the U.S., for providing philanthropy and funding those organizations, calling them on the carpet and saying they are going to second guess whether they continue to provide funding to those organizations. So will Harvard, for the rest of my time on this earth, always be seen as a prestigious university? I think so. Is this still a very difficult time for Harvard and USC and others, Penn State? Absolutely it is. And how they handle a minority of students, and I'm not questioning their ability to raise real concerns, but how they handle that while also the majority of students, I would suggest, ensure that they have a safe and positive time at university is what's going to be looked at and focused, and people will make judgments about the brand as a result.
And there's the sell of just the cost to wrap this up, because we've always looked south of the border and thought, or if we have U.S. Friends, relatives, whatever, and you're like, you guys pay like 36 grand tuition. Ours is still nine. Like, it's not nothing to send a kid to university here in Ontario. If anything, it ends up being the rent and the food. And if your kid needs a car in some of these cities that aren't Toronto to drive to campus. So if you're going to push that much money in all these American schools, I look at, Mike, and I think when parents are asked to be and make like it's $250,000 to $300,000 investment. So you got to make about $500,000 to afford that investment in after-tax money. Holy cow, you better be getting a great experience.
Right, and I think that's the key word, experience. The education you'd like to think is a given. They're going to go to class, they're going to have good professors, they're going to be challenged to think and learn how to think. But it's all what's being challenged now is all the experience around the classroom, getting to school, feeling safe, having the right to a graduation, going into your dorm and again, not being accosted by people who are pursuing their own ends. So it's a challenging time for universities. By and large, they do a great job, particularly here in Canada, where they do a really great job of providing those experiences for students. But it's a moment.
Yeah. We've got a couple minutes here. I want to ask you about TikTok, and we may be able to carry it through off the break. But the U.S. government's made a huge push, and they've moved really quickly on this. Some people think government moves at a glacial pace. The House of Representatives agreed, bipartisan vote, to either ban TikTok or force a sale of it from the Chinese-owned company that owns it. The Senate said yes this week. Joe Biden's already signed the legislation. Like, they got a lot of balls in the air. We mentioned the Middle East. Yeah. They're able to handle a TikTok bill. What about Canada and whether or not we fall or not? Because we're looking around going, yeah, we're pretty busy here, too. It feels like we got a lot of fires to put out, but doesn't even feel like our governments are talking about this.
No, it's strange. It feels like a blind spot for the Trudeau government, a government that has seemed to be slow off the mark to deal with foreign interference in Canada already. You know, this would be an easy one to say, we're concerned. The U.S. doesn't come to this decision out of nothing. You know, they have real concerns. And imagine the power of TikTok. It seems benign. You're flipping through videos of cats, but cats and bears juggling balls. But it is also the power of the Chinese government to just slowly promote certain videos. You know, we are in a war. You know, the West versus the East is in a war in Ukraine right now. And China is supporting Russia in this war. And the ability to them to just filter in just a few little videos here and there. Do we really need to support Ukraine? You know, is Putin really such a bad guy? You know, that subtle little influence that comes with owning a platform like that should be a concern. And I think, truthfully, our government's been a little slow to address it.
Mike Van Solen's with us. He's a communications and crisis expert. We were talking about that ban to move TikTok in the United States. And it's weird because yeah, we're not sort of in that moment right now in the U.S. where we can feel whether there's a bit of a, I think people are rolling their eyes right now saying, oh, yeah, sure. And next thing you know, try and download it on your phone. It's not there. Go for it on your phone. It's not there. Like, there are these restrictions. We've obviously got this with the Facebook Meta news ban at times.
Well, what I find really interesting, of course, Biden signed the legislation to set the wheels in motion for banning TikTok in the U.S. But at the same time, his own campaign is putting videos out on TikTok. So, you know, what's interesting about this is they want to get it TikTok out of the hands of the Chinese government, but no one politically wants to say, I actually want to kill TikTok. They just want it to be owned by someone in the U.S. because they want to use it. Like, politically, it is one of the most powerful tools.
You're reaching a younger demo. I know. Yeah.
So well, you know, the headlines might suggest they're banning TikTok, but TikTok's not going anywhere. It's still going to be used by young people. No one has to worry about losing that dopamine hit of flipping through those videos. But you're playing to one audience in saying we're going to wrestle this company out of the hands of the Chinese government. But you're also playing to another audience who really wants it, and they want to keep that association.
Does it switch? Do you think at any point, Mike, it switches to a more, I guess I would call it a conventional audience, to the point, as you're saying, it's kind of silly, it's kind of goofy, but I also think now organizations even like what we do at 640 and news organizations are starting to think about how to reach people and post more content on there. And remember the early days of Twitter. I remember, I think by the time my boss at the time said, you do a show, you got to be on Twitter. By the third email, I responded and he's like, I'm not asking you. I'm telling you, I would really just give it a shot. And I'm like, okay, yeah, I see where this would go. I see where this communicates with listeners. I see how this gets the brand out. Does TikTok become more like that? And we've all tried this with Facebook and Insta and a lot of stuff, and yet TikTok's sort of that outlier. Way more hits, but you don't necessarily see it as, how would I put it, mature content at times.
No, Marshall McLuhan, the medium is the message. So each of these platforms has a different way that they curate content, but I think we're all trying to figure out how do we play in these different mediums. Radio, talk radio still has a wonderful spot with listeners and that relationship it forms. But sure, you could be on TikTok too, and you would engage in a different way. The conversations wouldn't be quite in depth, but you are tapping into a group of people who may not drive, have access to a radio. But the content you're creating, curated across these different platforms, is what everybody's trying to figure out. And certainly marketers are trying to figure out, people who are running businesses are figuring out. And it may seem all light and fluffy, but it's still engagement. You're still having a conversation, but just in a way that we don't think of it traditionally.
Mike Van Solen's with us, a crisis communications expert for, we have a few more minutes with him. It's a tale as old as time itself. Or as long as people could fly, frustration with airlines. And again, things can go very viral in the last 15 years, and you've got platforms. Every single person has got a platform to complain about this, complain about that. You found a really interesting story about a wedding party headed to Jamaica, kind of one of these destination weddings, and just the simplest things started to go wrong.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. I just think customer service is so important. And I think it should be, companies should treat customers as well on the first day of that relationship as the last day. If I can call, for example, a telco and sign up for a cell phone with one phone call, I should be able to equally call them with one phone call and get out of that contract when it's the right time. But this is a story of Sunwing, a great company. I think a lot of us have, taken their vacations. They've figured out how to price their packages really effectively and get down there.
Yeah.
But then to hear a story where people clearly had their luggage rifled through, electronics stolen, and it's just, they're so slow to respond. And the challenge companies have is they want to have all the information before they say anything. But what they miss is that Canadians are very patient. They can understand that bad things can happen to a good company. So this looks like, some luggage handler somewhere along the line got into these people's luggage and took electronics. The company just needs to acknowledge, hey, we heard something bad happen. We're going to get the bottom of it. We'll get back to you. We're going to work with you to help and make this good. But they become paralyzed with indecision and lawyers talking in their ears, and they want to have all the information before they say anything because they think they'll be on the hook for some damages that maybe they shouldn't be. But taking care of that customer, once you have a relationship with them and communicating with them, even if you don't have all the information, say, we get it, we hear you, let us try to get to the bottom of it, is what they should do. So look, there may be layers to this story, but interesting once again to see a kind of a big company struggling to just move quickly in the face of a crisis.
Well, it's a 40-person wedding party. The trip goes well, the wedding goes well, but this is all on the way back. And the great question would be, and I think this is where, like you said, you get kind of hung up, almost the bigger corporation, the more hurdles to jump over. The great debate seemed to be, well, should the airline go to the airport, which is in Montego Bay, and say, this isn't us, this clearly happened on your watch. But in doing that, and the back and forth and emails and the grinding of the gears, you're delaying the customer, and the customer is thinking every day, why haven't they called me? Every day, why haven't they? We do this with our insurance companies too. An insurance company that gets to you right away, holy cow, that's worth its weight in gold if somebody's going to tell that story about how good an insurance company was responding to a claim. This is the opposite of that.
Exactly. I've worked with a lot of companies who've experienced data breaches. And when a data breach happens, their customers have to communicate to the customers. And the IT department doesn't actually know what happened. So I'm always having to coach them to go, we just have to, let's go out, let's talk to the customers, acknowledge that something has happened and that we're working to investigate it. And as soon as we have more information, we will get back to you. And that is just, sometimes it's too hard for companies just to make that step. Well, they want to figure it out first. They want to know everything that happened. And in this instance as well, the airline should contact those customers and say, we're going to get to the bottom of this. We don't have all the answers today, but we're going to get them to you. And they would feel so much better. They understand that that something like this can happen and that they may not have all the answers all the day. But what they can't stand is silence.
Last thing, we always debate companies that are, I wouldn't say uncancelable, but hard to cancel. And there's obviously great debate. It's a fun thing to do to go with your friend. Which of these two controversial figures is more likely to get canceled based on what they did or what they didn't do? And Adidas and Kanye West made a deal a few years ago, and it ended quite badly. But it doesn't seem to have hit Adidas terribly hard. And Kanye West could probably announce a show at Scotiabank Arena tomorrow, and it would be sold out within 10 minutes. So both these companies kind of emerged from a bit of an ugly moment.
Right. And it just shows, you know, we talk about living in cancel culture, but it's actually pretty hard to cancel a lot of companies or individuals. And I like to think about, you know, who's the Teflon Don? Nothing sticks to, you know, who certain people, you know, Donald Trump, I think, is the Teflon Don of politics today. Kanye West might be the Teflon Don of the music business. You know, what's interesting and what gets lost in this is Adidas didn't stop selling his shoes. They just stopped producing them. In their latest quarterly results, they said, oh, yeah, you know, we've ended our relationship with Kanye West. But his sneakers, by the way, we sold 150 million euros worth of them, and we made 50 million euros on them.
But they kind of pushed him out of ads, pushed him out of the mainstream. They didn't, like, he wasn't really promoting their product, right, or the shoes themselves.
Right. But Kanye West, for the vile anti-Semitic language he used, has not been canceled. You're right. He could still fill Scotiabank. He could probably find. He's not going to get a deal with Adidas, but he'll get branding deals still. He still exists, and maybe I don't listen to his music, but maybe that just speaks to, you know, as troubled a person as he is, what a talent he is in as a rapper.
And musicians are kind of that maverick. I think they can call their own shots more than they used to because the streaming services want all that catalog of music on. So you're not sort of, you still would be with a certain record company, but if a record company drops somebody, they're going to pick you up. Like we just saw Neil Young crawl back to Spotify because he was mad that Joe Rogan's podcast was also on Spotify. I'm like, you're going to find everything on Spotify. Yeah. You'll find people that believe aliens exist on Spotify on a regular basis. So if you pull your music, I think he realized after 2 years, he was kind of only damaging his own self and his own brand for being out there.
No, that's it. I mean, the artists now, you know, while the collapse of you know, records and record stores and the move to streaming seemed like an existential crisis at the time, I think what's emerged is they, as individually as artists and as brands, are more bulletproof than they used to be. They're more independent. They have more accesses. It's diverse, but more access to diverse streams of revenue, and they can call their shots in ways that they couldn't before. You know, we're certainly talking about the top, you know, 1% of artists in the world. I trust it's still a challenge for, you know, people starting out, but you know, Kanye West continues to persevere, and Neil Young, great example.
Mike, great pleasure having you in. Have a good weekend. We'll chat next Friday.
Happy Friday.
That was Mike Van Solen, and that is a wrap for this Toronto Today podcast for this Friday. Catch us live Monday to Friday, 5:30 to 9 a.m., and come back tomorrow as well for a recap of the day's best talkers on the Toronto Today podcast. Have a great weekend.